This is Chapter a Day. I'm Susan Sweeney. Our Lady of Perpetual Hunger is our book. It's a memoir from noted pastry chef Lisa Donovan. Life has finally taken a positive turn for Lisa and her young family. John's new tenure-track teaching job at a nearby university and Lisa's waitstaff job at Nashville's fine French restaurant Margot Cafe have lifted the Donovans out of their desperate financial insecurity. At Margot, Lisa watches, learns, grows, and remembers her own early dreams about a life creating beautiful food. Chapter 8, Our Lady of Perpetual Hunger. My time at Margot Cafe led me toward more. It led me to the first place I ever worked pastry, a place called City House. And City House happened for me because I met Anne Kostrowski at Margot Cafe and Bar, a decidedly local place, but not one without big-time ambitions. City House was helmed by Anne and her then-husband, Tandy Wilson, a prodigal son raised in the high cotton suburbs of Nashville, who returned home to do good for his town. And he certainly did, with enormous help from his very well-established father. I was invited to help open City House in 2007 with and by Anne, a pastry chef trained at the Culinary Institute of America, who had moved to town with Tandy from California. We all worked together at Margot, where Tandy was the sous chef, and Anne took a job as a server, making more money than being Margot's pastry chef would have provided, so that they could save and afford to take time off, eventually, to build their restaurant. Anne became a work acquaintance and the first co-worker I started to talk to about the little makeshift bake shop I was running out of my apartment. Margot had agreed that people could pick up their orders from me at the restaurant if it was before 5 p.m. Anne started to take an interest in what she saw. She was curious where I learned how to make what she deemed a professional-looking product, and I think she was interested in my desire to learn from her every chance I got. Every conversation being a strange and overly eager picking of her brain, I asked many questions, and she was very patient. The day I made a birthday cake for a fellow server and a dear friend, 4 layers of red velvet, decorated and sculpted to look like Dolly Parton with giant cupcake breasts wearing a strapless gown with a flame job, the only themed cake I would do, her interest piqued. The day I brought a stone fruit strudel to a staff party with damn near perfect flakes of pastry braided and egg washed, baked to a beautiful golden color, filled with roasted plums and apricots, however, she wanted to know what the hell was going on and why I was not doing it more and professionally. This was my first relationship as a baker, with a baker who actually knew that world. Anne had been a pastry chef at Trévigne in Napa Valley, working in the glamorous vineyards under and around other professional cooks who ran the same circles as Thomas Keller and Alice Waters. Now here she was, excited and impressed by me and the things I was cobbling together out of a small antique oven in an outdated kitchen with whatever ingredients I could afford. So when the offer was made to try that career on for size, I went along with Anne and Tandy when they decided to start City House, the primary school where I cut my teeth and never looked back. City House undoubtedly helped put Nashville on the map as a culinary destination. It is a beautiful space, once the home and studio of an important Nashville sculptor named Alan LeQuire. The kitchen served smart and very pointedly beautiful but never pretentious food, something that, besides Margot Cafe, was new to Nashville. There was a dedication to local ingredients that Nashville hadn't seen yet. Inspired by Italy's decidedly simple yet perfectly executed style, with things that mattered and were honest to our region, City House thrived. My role was marginal at first, assisting Anne, organizing, cooking, training, and learning, first by her side and then, within a few weeks, mostly on my own, while she trained servers and dealt with the wine program. She gave me a lot of room to learn, to ask questions, to settle into my new place, my new career. The restaurant was widely praised and nearly an immediate wild success in town, and there started to be hints of national recognition. Their marriage, however, didn't last, and Anne would leave within mere months of the restaurant's opening. My career, though, the one I finally admitted to myself that I wanted, got started because Anne asked me to join her and proceeded to give me a space and a small starter pack of a dozen or so beautifully written recipes to grow into. Our time together was short, but those few months were a crash course in technique, quality control over large batches, math, balancing a menu, and tasting everything you touch, from your ingredients to your final products. Things happened very quickly from there. Once the dust settled from Anne's sudden departure, Tandy walked in through the back door and took me aside to say, "You have big shoes to fill. Can you do it?" I said, "Yes, absolutely." Went out back, called John and told him I could not pick up the kids from school that day, and stepped up without a moment's hesitation. I took over for Anne in more ways than one. I was all in. She'd also run the front of house, and so that was left unattended in her absence as well. Thus there were many days, many, many, many days, actually, perhaps a whole year's worth of days, when I would arrive as soon as I dropped my kids off at school and preschool, work pastry alone alongside two men who ran the rest of the kitchen, the sous chefs, who would become my brothers forever, and try to crank out some of the best and most welcoming food Nashville had ever seen. Then I would go to the bathroom around 4 p.m., wash my face, change my clothes, and get ready to help run service. I would run service, wait tables, close the restaurant, somehow not feeling a lick of exhaustion in my bones. Everything about being there felt correct and aspirational, daily. At night I'd go home, riding high off of seeing my food served to guests, taking inventory the whole time of what worked, what didn't work, and I'd lie in my bed reading more books, taking more notes, writing more ideas into my recipe book. Then I'd get up at 5 a.m. to feed my baby's breakfast, send John off to his day at the university, pack the lunches, and get the kids to school, and I'd do it all over again the next day and the day after that. I treated that place as my own and loved every minute of it. I was given loads of room to make mistakes, but only once, maybe twice. City House became a second home and the kitchen crew an extension of my family. Not out of obligation, but because we really loved and cared about one another and put the success of that restaurant as a top priority. Here was where I started to understand Margot's aspirations for me in her restaurant and what I was missing in my absence. I was a fast learner, very dedicated. I started cultivating my own style of menu there, simple desserts, that focused on flavor and tradition and ingredients. We would put out a basic panna cotta, but it would be made with beautiful buttermilk from Cruz Farm in Knoxville. Buttermilk so important and otherworldly that it literally changed the direction of my entire menu after the first time a friend walked through our back door with a case full of it. We all tasted it, our eyes widening with each sip. It was buttermilk that, after you tried it, made you realize that you had to rethink everything about what you were doing in order to accommodate it. It was robust and clean, rich and tangy, but not too tangy, and the most beautiful color of cream you'd ever seen. The yellow was just subtle enough that you wondered if you'd ever own a house just so you could paint all the walls the same shade and live inside the creamy thought of buttermilk for the rest of your life. The farmers who made it, Earl and Sherry Cruz and their daughter Colleen, would joke about how their buttermilk not only accounted for a good, sturdy, long life, but also for Earl's sturdy constitution and constant fire for Mrs. Cruz. While I knew there was something special about the Cruz's buttermilk, I'll admit to feeling like it was connecting me to something that I was only on the periphery of, something I wanted to be less adjacent to and feel more as my own. I was searching for that thing, that southern thing that my daddy has always carried with him, the one that encourages him to crumble cornbread into milk, or better yet, buttermilk when it's around. The very southern thing and the basic simplicity of how it's made, by letting the leftover milk from making butter sour to fortify and get richer with funk and fat and age, an industrious byproduct that farmers figured out gave them strength and virility. Buttermilk was a key, helped me work out the weird distance that I felt from being southern. I'm faulty for romanticizing any number of things. I know this about myself. Buttermilk, though, deserves it all. In turn, I wanted it to be center stage in everything I made. It always arrived smuggled into the back door of the restaurant like a black market ingredient because no distributors carried it. We had carriers, friends we could pay with food, who would bring as much as they could tote at any time they were passing through East Tennessee. Cruz's Buttermilk arrived right when I found my stride at writing my menu, and it became a signature ingredient of my desserts at City House. Tandy had held my hand for long enough after Ann left, and then one day it seemed he realized the menu was mine, my voice, my style, and my way of being warm and hospitable at the end of a meal. To this day, all of my menus reflect the way the one at City House looked, because it came from a very sincere place inside me. Cookies were Tandy's idea to honor his admiration for an Italian menu, but I created a space for layer cakes, for pies, for simple and salty crumbles on top of pudding. Once I started developing the menu and writing my own recipes, I found myself building everything around a sincere style of dessert that I was really proud of, one that felt totally honest. That panna cotta, topped with just sweetened enough roasted fruit, or a gelée that I had to call Jell-O to get by Tandy's obsession with not seeming pretentious, and to circumnavigate his then-hatred for fancy French techniques. Slightly salty cookies, grain crumbles with peanuts or pecans, cast-iron cornmeal cakes with buttermilk gelato and honey crunch, cantaloupe sherbet with watermelon granita and a pinch of Maldon sea salt, olive and Sinclair chocolate pudding cups with tangy creme fraiche and a perfectly bourbony butterscotch gelato or pie. Cookie plates on cookie plates on cookie plates. These were all the things that were at once uncomplicated and thoughtfully prepared. Nothing flashy, just good, just delicious, and ultimately, just comforting. This became the way I made desserts for life. It was me finding my voice as a pastry chef. I took the technical prowess that Anne had imparted to me in such a short time, the culinary techniques to make sure your product is consistent and beautiful, and all the things I had taught myself of French and American baking, and combined it with Tandy's guidance and restraints, some good and important ones, like how to plate without overwhelming the guest, and some annoying and short-sighted, like never being allowed to use vanilla. And I made desserts that I am still proud of today. I was extremely proud of the work I was doing and was constantly engaged in it. I became enthralled by ingredients. I lived for the seasons. I had a running list of ideas in my head, in my notebooks, on the wall above my pastry table. I realized what I was good at, flavor, and what I was bad at, presentation, and really homed in on, respectively, owning this and overcoming that. There was nothing I wanted to do more than be at my pastry table, working out a gelato recipe or fine-tuning a ciabatta loaf for the wood-fired oven. I was doing right by the moment I seized when I said yes to Tandy's Big Shoes offer. I felt not only that I'd found my place, but also that I had earned it. One of my most important mementos from City House is a note left by Margot McCormick after she had dinner there one night, written on the back of one of my dessert menus, which said, "Perfect desserts. Keep going," with her name written inside a heart with an arrow going through it. At the end of the day, however, the hard and good work I loved was not enough. After 2 years of deep commitment, of bringing my best, I had to leave City House. Opening a restaurant is incredibly difficult, and I understand the margins, especially all these years later. I basically understood it then, too, and I tucked into the work, believing that I was helping to build something bigger than myself, believing when the owner told me that my raise was coming, he promised, as soon as he could, I believed him. And I did feel extremely lucky to be there, learning from really good cooks, having the chance to build my recipes, my skills, and my worth, working toward my own future, I thought. If it had just been me, paying rent on a small apartment and eating only at work, sacrificing my quality of life for a job I truly loved, it would have been fine, even though it should not have been. Everyone deserves for their employers to care about an idea as fundamental as quality of life. Regardless, I had a family I was 50% responsible for financially. They were having to sacrifice in ways that were not fair. My husband was working a tenure-track job, doubling up his salary in the summer by installing art at the airport and at local galleries, but this was barely enough to cover rent, utilities, car payments, and other essential overhead necessary to keep a family afloat. Professors don't make what you think. Those days are long gone. The money I made had to cover food, daycare, clothing, a flip phone, dental visits, doctor visits, gas, and the paltry amount of enrichment we could afford for the kids. I wasn't asking for much, not even a salary, but I did need something to compensate for the increased responsibilities I'd been given, had stepped up to, and been successful at. Things were tight, but the Donovan crew knows how to buckle down better than anyone when we care about something. So we buckled down. I was just turning 30. By then I knew I wanted my own place, a bakery, someday. And I thought these were still appropriate sacrifices to make to build a future, to be determined about something with a little risk and sacrifice. We were all committed to that restaurant in one way or another, and I believed very earnestly that I could be there for 5 or 6 more years and then maybe open my bakery next door to work with and near those guys for as long as I could. And so I waited. The final straw came when I asked for my first raise for the third time over the course of the second year. I received my first yes, but to a terribly insulting raise of 25 cents more an hour, and then was told, "That's all I can do right now. I know you'll be fine, though, right, with John's teaching salary?" I know the question may have come from a place of concern, a revealing, antiquated place of concern, but a concern nonetheless. But it was salt in the wound, as if I needed the raise less than anyone else in that kitchen because, what, I was just a wife who was playing dress-up as a pastry chef? Because I was not the head of the household? I worked my butt off for Tandy and his sole proprietorship restaurant. He didn't have a board of directors to answer to, just him and his dad deciding the value of everything and everyone. So there I was, struggling to make ends meet with Maggie Donovan on site during my work hours because I could not afford daycare or even a cheap babysitter. I'd been giving Tandy credit as a cool boss who let my kid hang out during my work hours. But really, what it boiled down to was that I was not being compensated reasonably enough to justify my job there if I could not even afford proper daycare for my kid. By my estimation, that raise should have been offered the moment those big shoes were presented for me to fill. And here I was, groveling for 25 cents more an hour, nearly a year and a half later. Meanwhile, the sous chefs made salaries and were taken seriously, as if their lives and expenses were more real than mine. And even though I was proud of my work and felt confident that our customers were happy with what came out of my station, I know with every fiber of my being that my work and focus and discipline would have skyrocketed if I'd had to worry less about juggling money and family issues with my work life. If I could have afforded a basic thing like daycare, that would have been a small investment for Tandy to better not only my situation, but his as well. Within a week of me being asked if my husband's salary would make up for his lack of return investment in me, he bragged that he was going to spend some extra cash flow on building a very expensive smoke shed out back. And then, 4 days later, he hired yet one more sous chef on salary for his own benefit, making for a total of three for a kitchen open only 6 days a week and only for dinner service. I realized, plainly and bleakly, that he was never going to respect me as an actual cook in his kitchen, no matter how productive and successful I was, that he'd apparently forgotten all about the conversation I'd had with him just a week before about the trouble I was in, about how I was reaching a breaking point and keeping everything together for my family with this job. Ultimately, I got to a place where I simply refused to suffer for his obvious disregard of how dedicated I was to him and to my work. I still did not want to buy into the narrative that I was possibly being treated differently because of my gender. And I felt guilt, always guilt, for not being grateful enough, for not being able to just put my head down, ignore the reality in front of me, and keep working like I was expected to, like all the women before me had, in order to earn their place in kitchens like this one. Plus, Tandy cared about me, I kept telling myself. He was giving me a chance, I kept telling myself. Over and over, I thought, did I do enough? Did I work hard enough? What else could I have done to earn my place? I carried the weight of jobs that weren't even technically mine, helping to make sure the front of house did not fall apart, picking up server shifts when we'd get a no-show, working the cold app dessert station a few nights when cooks were short. And instead of being treated like an important part of the kitchen, of the restaurant at large, I was treated like a sister just doing the owner a favor, helping him through an emotionally exhaustive time in his own life, instead of being a valued employee. I trusted him to do right by me and was willing to wait, willing to be dedicated to something that did not seem all that dedicated to me. It broke my heart to leave that job, and it broke the boys' hearts, too, including the one who realized too late that he had made a big mistake. He came to me after I put in my notice and admitted, to his credit, that he was wrong and that he was very upset I was leaving and that he did not want to do without me, that he wanted to talk out how to make it work. I think it was a hard lesson for him, and I think he was embarrassed that someone saw him being less than he was capable of being. We had a sweet moment, and I regretted that I was having to leave. Time was up, and I had to make some hard choices. That is the reality when you are a mother. Stuff is real, and there are real consequences to decisions. I couldn't stay. And anyway, I've learned from previous experiences that if someone values you only when you're about to walk out the door, you should definitely keep walking. I went back to Margot Cafe to regroup, but this time I came back as her pastry chef, not just as a struggling young mother and server with a steep learning curve. She welcomed me, knowing I was having a hard time juggling my family with the energy of a new restaurant. Or, at least that's the line I sold her. I wasn't willing at that time to complain about how much bull I was dealing with. I could hardly admit it to myself. The energy of a new restaurant was just fine with me. I actually loved it. I was thriving in my work, at my craft, despite the very real threat of becoming broke beyond repair, looming around every corner. Margot could pay me a little better, but the work was not the same. It was easier. She had established a routine, kind of predictable menu, so this was basically a job I could do with ease and with less expectation to be great, as it were. She let me play. She let me experiment. But ultimately, I was to keep within a very simple, beautiful lane of seasonal crostata with her ice cream base, her sorbet recipes, her cake recipes, It was good practice. It was a place to catch my breath, to perfect my technique. John and I had finally figured out a schedule that worked for our family, and throughout it all, he was head over heels supportive of my work, doing the dance between our worlds so beautifully and amicably in ways I had never seen a man rise up for his woman. My aprons would be washed and folded for my next day's work, and back when I was pulling all those doubles at City House, a bowl of pasta would be kept warm on the stove, waiting for me at night when I came home late. If he could carry any of the weight of how hard I was working, he did. My time at Margot was a nice reprieve for him as well. By now I could see what the industry gave, but I could also see what it took. So when I stepped away and took that long breath at Margot, I agreed that I would always be honest with myself about whether or not it made sense, whether or not, as a person with responsibilities beyond my own wants and needs, I was even allowed to keep trying to fit myself back into that world. There weren't a lot of mothers at two, or even women in general, hustling up in a kitchen. And I was starting to wonder if that was a sign. I spent my time at Margot, taking an honest look at the work I now knew I never wanted to be without, but also wondering if I was completely out of place in that world, one that clearly needed me to forsake living a life that made any sustainable sense. I weighed my options and kept circling around the idea of graduate school, of returning to the life goals I had before my pregnancy with Joseph so many years earlier. As much as those intentions no longer felt immediate, I was tired, and I wanted to have credentials. I wanted my value to be on paper. I wanted to get a job that no man could tell me I didn't deserve, or I wasn't worth being paid enough to do. I didn't really want to be a museum archivist or scholar anymore. I just wanted to screw up anyone's ability to keep me so close to poverty's edge. And a fancy degree felt like the only way to achieve that. The only thing I knew for certain was that I wanted to stay in the kitchen. I wanted to keep feeding people, and I really wanted to do it as my job for as long as I could. We're reading from Lisa Donovan's memoir, Our Lady of Perpetual Hunger, published in 2020 by Penguin Books. I'm Susan Sweeney. Join us for more from Our Lady of Perpetual Hunger, next time on Chapter a Day.